Hey, everybody. In this episode of I Talk Movies, we're getting up close and personal with director and writer Von Stein. Let's do it.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk. We talk movies. And then, here's Popcorn Talk's I Talk Movie.
Hey, everybody. Donald Glover's This Is America plays us into this episode of I Talk Movies. This is the show where we get up close and personal with the people both in front and behind the camera to bring you all that great entertainment you get to see in the theaters, at home, or on your mobile streaming device. I'm your host, Frank Moran. And my guest today is been involved in such productions as Beauty and the Beast, World War Z, Les Miserables, both Sherlock Holmes and the TV show Elementary, and much more. He's making his feature film directorial and writing debut with Terminal, which comes out in theaters and on demand on May 11th, starring Margot Robbie, Mike Myers, and Simon Pegg. Please welcome Von Stein.
Good evening.
Good evening. Look at that. We've done it. Yes. So a murderer's row of talent you've got assembled for this film.
An amazing, amazing world-class cast. It was an honor. I have no idea how we managed to pull it off, but they all came to Budapest for 27 days and shot a indie thriller, noir, revenge-driven great piece of cinema, hopefully.
Absolutely. Now, to jump back for one second, usually we like to have the guest kind of pick a film, a song that kind of is inspiring them or is on top of mind at the moment. You picked This Is America, and you were just saying, before we started, how impressive that this video was to you. What was it about this that really just spoke to you?
Oh, it's astonishing. Simon Pegg introduced it to me a few days ago, and I can't stop watching it. It's just an unbelievable piece of choreography, amazing satire. It speaks volumes about kind of America today, an unbelievable Donald Glover performance. Just brilliant. Really, really inspiring. Check it out.
So for you as a creator, when you are watching somebody else kind of really inspire you, what's that do for what you want to start working on or how it influences on something you may already be working on at the moment?
I think for me, when something grabs me, like, you know, when you see something truly inspiring, when it be it film or music or something that, for me, it's often story. I often find that I'm really drawn into really great storytelling, and it can be anything. You know, I'm attracted to certain genres, but when something grabs you, you know it. You get that feeling in your gut, right, that you want to emulate and elevate it.
So, well, let's see what kind of led you down this road. You grew up in London, born and raised?
I did, yeah.
And when did you start kind of getting the film bug, so to speak?
Pretty early on. I definitely watched a lot of wildly inappropriate films when I was the wrong age. I remember seeing, like, Silence of the Lambs when I was 12, I think. And I remember watching Seven in my parents' room on their TV. I must have been, it must be 11 or 12. And they got home. So I didn't know the ending. Spoiler alert, I didn't know about the head in the box for about 3 years until I saw it again.
I would like to say, you still don't know what the ending is.
Oh, no, I can't go back to it. No, it's traumatized me. No, I do know, thankfully.
So but, was it just that if your parents would have known, like, Von, you're not supposed to be watching films like this?
No, they would have actively encouraged it. It was just easier to do when they were out.
Yeah.
But I really fell in love with it when I think I was about 15, 16. I had a really inspiring teacher at school, as I think most people do when they fall in love with something. And he taught a general studies module in the history of cinema, and it was called From Hitchcock to Spielberg. And we looked at sort of 12 auteurs of the sort of latter half of the 20th century, and we saw some unbelievable films, and it really had a lasting effect on me. It really made me fall in love with cinema.
Now, when you decide you want to pursue that as a career, are your parents on board with that, or like, oh, that's a tough career path to take, maybe you should do something a little safer?
No, totally. They were really happy they'd sweated blood to send us all to private school so that I could throw it away making tea and coffee. No, they were incredibly supportive, and I'll be forever grateful to them for that support. Especially when I was, you know, borrowing money when I was a runner and couldn't find work.
Do you have siblings?
I do, a brother and a sister, both younger.
And did they follow the path into entertainment as well, or are they kind of pursuing other things?
No, they do worthwhile things. My sister's a teacher. My brother did some running, actually. He worked with me on Pirates of the Caribbean, but he is an excellent conference producer now.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So when you, I guess I'm kind of, maybe many of the audience is kind of familiar with sort of the, if you're taking film studies or you're going to study film here in the States, what the process is like. But did you study in the UK?
We do. I mean, I studied drama. We have great film schools, but I read drama at the University of Bristol, which is actually where Pegg went, which was a great course. And I sort of tailored mine towards film and film theory. But I knew from pretty early on that I wanted to get practical experience. I wanted to get into the trenches on a film set. And I didn't want to go back into full-time education, so I decided to try and sort of earn my stripes as a runner as early as possible rather than sort of going to a specific film school.
Now, pardon my ignorance, in terms of the runner, I'm imagining sort of like is it more of like a PA, or is it something even more elevated than that?
No, it's a PA. Okay. There's an old maxim in British film. They're not called runners because they run around. They're called runners because they run the floor. And it's totally true. You know, you're involved in everything. It's the lowest rung of the assistant director ladder, effectively. And the next step up is third assistant director. Then you move to second assistant director, eventually to first assistant director. And I loved it. I absolutely loved making films, and I loved being on these sets. And I was very lucky and to work with amazing people who sort of took me under their wing and put me on their team. And I worked on some incredible films over the sort of 6 or 7 years I was doing it.
As a runner, is it much like anything where some people enjoy being in that and learning from the ground up, and some people might find like, oh, I'm just doing all the scut work. This is not what I dreamed it was going to be. You know what? I'm good. I'm going to tap out and do something else.
100%. The fallout rate's high. It's attritional. Like it's hard. The hours are long. The money is terrible. There's lots of standing around in car parks at 4 o'clock in the morning in the pouring rain, you know, waiting for the cast to arrive to get them out of the cars and into makeup. But it's amazing. I mean, you learn it from the ground up. And I always wanted to get my hands dirty. I always wanted to get to the coal face. And, you know, I found I was hopefully pretty good at it. And, you know, film is a passion, isn't it? You know, if we wanted to make money, we'd be bankers. And it's doing something you love and learning how to do it, you know, nuts and bolts is an amazing experience and totally worthwhile.
Is it a struggle to move up at the beginning, or is it if you are smart and competent, people will see that and opportunities will start presenting themselves?
I think it's both. There's a lot of field promotions in film. You know, like you're in the right place at the right time, and someone, you know, realizes you can dress crowd, or someone realizes you're, you know, good with call sheets, and you move up that way. But you tend to work in teams, and teams are very loyal. You know, you do, it's long hours. It's not great money, and you sort of band together, and you know, if you can make it fun and enjoy yourself and do a good job, it's a great place to be.
I imagine that kind of loyalty that develops with amongst a team, very much a sense where as soon as the first person makes it, that kind of opens the door for like, I'm bringing my buddies with me. That helped me out get this to this point.
Yeah, which is lovely. And it's the same with all departments, I guess, in film. It's, you know, people love working with people that they trust, that they know they're going to have a good time with, and also that they do the job to the best it can be done.
I mentioned as a runner, though, which is nice to be able to touch on all departments of a production. So now as you make your way up the directorial ranks, now directing your first film, you have a good sense of what every department is done, what they need to operate efficiently?
For me, yeah. I mean, that's what I took the most from it. And if I thought of it as much as an apprenticeship, as a job, being able to work directly with all of these different departments to understand how they dovetail, how set works, how everything sort of combines in order to make the film. I mean, an assistant director's job is to facilitate the director's vision. We work for the director, and we coordinate all of these other departments and make sure that, you know, the days run to time, everything's where it should be, and sort of, you know, help everyone around us, you know, make the best film they can and make the day, as per call sheet, as the saying goes, right?
For you, as you're coming up in the ranks and you, with the eye of directing, as you're trying to service these directors' visions, you're kind of working to broadcast, put their vision on camera.
Yeah.
But you're also working to develop your own style as well. So for you, is it sort of like you will just kind of you're a sum of your influences, and then you find out how you can take that in a direction that's uniquely your own?
It was incredible. I was so lucky and humbled to work with amazing directors, amazing producers, writers, actors, you know, to see the way that they did it and to try and learn and to try and emulate that. And, you know, from when I was a runner, I really enjoyed, you know, being on the periphery of those really important conversations and listening to what was discussed creatively and practically. And, you know, I was inspired by so many of the directors I worked with. And you know, it was a pleasure to watch them interact with the cast, the way they gave notes, the way they would work with their department heads. You know, it was an amazing, amazing apprenticeship for me.
Well, I have to imagine, as much as you see how you would want to run your own set, you may encounter some points where you see like, nope, I do not want to run a set like this.
My God, yes. Yeah. I mean, of course, like, you know, there's like, everyone has different processes and you know, everyone works in different ways. I'm a really collaborative person. I love to work in a really positive environment, and the directors I learned the most from were the ones who, you know, cultivated and created that kind of set and that kind of atmosphere. And you know, for example, Bill Condon was a huge influence on me, who I did The Fifth Estate and Beauty and the Beast with, who is just the most wonderfully mild man and so intelligent and so, you know, so charismatic and just brilliant at conveying ideas. He works so well with cast and crew, and you love him, you know, you want to go the extra mile for him. And for me, you know, especially the way I was very lucky to be involved in rehearsals on both films with him, and to see the way that he would communicate with his actors and the way that he utilized the rehearsal process in order to sort of, you know, maximize the time he had on set, I thought was really, really impressive. I learned a great deal from him.
So for you, as you're coming up, did you feel yourself that your strengths were more, I'm leaning more towards like the technical side, I can execute that well, but my working with the cast might be a little daunting, or were you the opposite?
No, I think I was the opposite, actually. Like, the human element of it, I never found intimidating. Like, I came from theatre. I was used to, you know, I acted when I was a kid. I know that feeling. I know how terrifying it is to be standing in front of those lights. I know what a lonely place it can be, and I have a kind of a natural empathy and admiration for actors for what they can do in that way. And also, as you know, as a runner, you and as an AD, you sort of look after all the human elements. Like, we work very closely with the cast, and we work closely with stunts and extras. We're very good at sort of coordinating the human elements of the filmmaking process.
Vaughn has learned a lot in his time as a runner, growing up to being the writer and director that we know today. But if you want to have fun, learn, and grow on all aspects of life, then we've got a podcast for you. And that is Conversations with Marie Menounos, created by our AfterBuzz TV founder, and drops on iTunes every single Friday. Conversations with Marie Menounos features celebrity and influencer interviews and touches on all aspects of life, from health and wellness to career and relationships, finances, and more. Let our Maria be the big sister that you never had. So just go to iTunes and subscribe to Conversations with Marie Menounos for free. And when you do, let her know that it was iTalk Movies and the Popcorn Talk Network that got you there. Conversations with Marie Menounos. Check it out. All right. So, Vaughn, you were mentioning several influences that helped kind of shape Terminal that you're working on. And one that you said was kind of the graphic novel palette. Growing up, were you a comic book reader?
Not a massive one. No, I
this
love.
The interview's over then.
Yeah, we're done. Headphones off. Mic dropped. No, I love them aesthetically. Like, I read a fair few, and I started actually reading a lot more once the idea of Terminal was beginning to sort of gestate properly. But for me, I just think they're beautiful. Like, I love flicking through them. I love looking at the way that they visualize a story. I think it's incredible. And there's something about them. There's something about that sort of heightened sensationalist feel that they can have, and the way they sort of touch on our world a lot of the time. And you can have these incredibly dynamic, interesting, you know, kind of hyper-real characters that really appeal to me.
So as Terminal starts kind of percolating in your head, had you been writing other projects as well, and this was Terminal is kind of one that first came to fruition, or had you been trying to write other productions before Terminal?
So I'd written since university, and I often played with ideas and motifs, and I'd written scripts before, but I wrote Terminal, what I would consider the proper, like, you know, nuts and bolts first draft in 2013. And it was a sort of distillation of three unhealthy obsessions, really. I loved film noir. I loved the evolution of noir, and, you know, especially the way that it's kind of developed into these amazing, you know, the subgenres of sort of sci-fi noir, the hard-boiled noir, the dystopian noir. And I just thought it would be really interesting to combine that with my love of sort of dystopian cinema and literature. It was, you know, I think it's an amazing canvas against which to tell a story, dystopia. And I sort of wanted to fuse those together, and that gave rise to this kind of vast anonymous city that Terminal takes place in. And then, you know, to utilize the palette and the aesthetics of the graphic novel to kind of, that sort of gave rise to that sort of neon-drenched nightmare, as I invented the other day and think it's really good. that sort of feel that I wanted to combine into it. So I think it was world first for me, actually.
Like, okay.
And I'd always had this idea of a central female protagonist who was able to utilize all of the tools at her disposal in order to kind of ensnare the men around her, who could sort of, you know, turn everything on its head and be all things to all men, play whatever they wanted her to be in order to achieve her aims. And yeah, the sort of the character sprung up around Annie. She was first and foremost in my mind.
So as you said, you had written from university on. Was Were there times where you're like, I'm not quite ready yet to direct a film, so I'm just going to keep writing and kind of just put this down for right now, and at some point I'm going to feel like, yep, I'm ready to take the next step and actually both write and direct a film?
No, I was utterly arrogant. I knew I didn't know. Absolutely, yeah. I think a really big step for me actually was I was working on a film called Heart of the Sea, the Ron Howard film about Herman Melville.
Chris Hemsworth.
A brilliant film. And I tore a muscle in my back while we were filming on a gimbal rig in Leavesden Studios. And I was sort of laying on my girlfriend's floor, staring up at the ceiling, waiting for painkillers to kick in. I was like, I've got to, you know, because I couldn't work. I had to quit, unfortunately. And I thought, I've got to do something. I've got to take the next step. And I'd heard a story on the radio about a boy who'd kind of washed up in southern Italy and was about to be committed to a mental institution. That he was mute, he wouldn't say anything. And as they were about to commit him, he basically said in halting Italian, I'm not nuts. I haven't got much to say at the moment. And this story came out of him. He was a Congolese refugee who'd sort of made his way up and crossed over into Italy, and he'd been a child soldier. And it just really affected me. And that was kind of the beginning of the migrant crisis going on in Europe. And I sort of reimagined that story slightly for a sort of British sensibility. And it became a film called Yusuf is Complicated, which we shot at the end of 2013 and did pretty well kind of on the festival circuit. It did well at TIFF and at Chicago, and it sort of really gave me the confidence to kind of, you know, push on. And I'd written Terminal actually within that same sort of window of time. And so Tom Ackerley and Josie McNamara, who are Margot's producing partners, they own Lucky Chap together. We were runners and assistant directors together in the UK film industry. Yeah, we were often on the same teams, and we used to share work out, and we were good buds, and we sort of always talked about, you know, making films together, you know, while running around with tea and coffee and setting background and, you know, turning up to work hungover. And they were, you know, it was serendipity. They were living with Margs at the time. She was overshooting Tarzan. I'd met her socially. We'd got on really well. She actually gave me some notes on my short, though I'm sure she wouldn't remember it. And she was sitting at her kitchen table one day, and she picked up the script that I'd given to them to have a look at, and she started reading it, and she was like, this is nuts. This is totally weird. Let's do it. So we met a couple of weeks afterwards, and we had an amazing meeting, and we wanted to work on the script. We wanted to finesse and polish it and, you know, improve it. And she was incredible at it. She's a brilliantly intelligent reader, an amazing sort of, you know, amazing collaborator. And we really worked and honed it and sort of, you know, brought other elements into it and sort of tried to improve it as a script. And we did, I think. And
that's because I feel like it's what it's a talent and timing that can create an opportunity for you. So I feel like many people are like, oh, if I could only get the script in the hands of somebody that might be interested in wanting to do some of this. And you've written this great script, and then just by happenstance, Margot Robbie just happens to be hanging out, and then boom, there you go. That just starts the ball rolling. How much in terms do you feel like, in terms of filmmaking, does just, I guess, I don't want to say like luck, but a sense that's kind of a key component in getting production off the ground?
Unequivocally. I think if you were to ask anyone who is in any situation within the industry, they would say that something happened, they knew someone, they met someone, they ran into someone, and you know, great things happen from that. You know, the best thing you can do is put yourself in the situation. Like, you know, it was a pleasure and a privilege to work on film sets for as long as I did, and I learned so much. It gave me the confidence to push on, and, you know, and serendipity struck.
Were you somebody that always had to say yes to whatever came up to you, because you never knew when, like, there could be a dry spell, so I got to just keep saying yes because I never know when the filmmaking opportunities could end for me?
Yeah, and I think, you know, if I don't think, you know, beggars can't be choosers when it comes to this sort of stuff, and also, you know, when you work practically in film, often the projects you think you're going to hate, you have the most amazing time on, you know. And sometimes you do things and you work on floors that, you know, you might be doing, like, you know, wishy-washy romantic comedies, and it's a terrible environment to work in. Or, you know, you're working on really bleak kind of subject matter, and, you know, half the time you're in hysterics because the director's so funny. It's amazing. Of course, I was never in a position that I could really pick and choose projects. I worked with teams, and I would always hope that the team I was on were on a good one.
Well, it's got to be nice to having that idea, like, hey, if any of us make it, they'll help somebody else out along the way, to now be in that situation where you now have worked with these people, have created a great relationship, and it pays off in the sense where now they're in a position to be able to help your production come to life.
I think for me, where it most counted was with the crew. We had the most astonishing department heads, the most wonderfully talented people, and they brought all of their sort of creative guile, all of their know-how, and all of their patience to bear. And the vast majority I had worked with as an assistant director, Chris Ross, our cinematographer, who's did the most astonishing job with, you know, no time and no money. I mean, it's beautiful. And Richard Bullock, the production designer, who, you know, joined the team sort of, I hadn't worked with him before, but I knew him by reputation, just the lovely man who joined sort of 5 weeks before, 5 weeks out when we'd just moved to Budapest, and just transformed these huge spaces into, you know, some sort of anachronistic dystopian wet dream. And Julian Day, the costume designer who I met through Heart of the Sea, the most wonderfully talented designer, and Sally J, the hair and makeup designer. I mean, Nigel Watson, the first AD. I was so lucky. So many people kind of went to bat for me, people I'd met and known. And we had the most amazing line producer, a guy called Danny Gulliver, who held everything together kind of against all the odds, because independent filmmaking is hard, and it, you know, there's peaks and troughs. And yeah, he you know, saw it through from London Wreckers to Budapest Wreckers to Budapest Shoot, you know, did the most amazing job.
Well, I feel like that must be that is a testament to yourself for how well regarded you are within the industry that you're working in, because when the time comes and you want to reach out for these people to help, they are all on board.
Yeah, I have dark secrets on all of them.
That's right, you have dossiers on all of them.
Thank you. And I worked hard. I think the thing is, it's an amazingly supportive industry film, and you know, amazing things happen on film sets, and you know, it's a great, great place to be and to work, and you meet wonderful people, and people support and inspire you, and you know, it's great.
So for you, as you're writing Terminal, and this is before Margot Robbie has read it, and you start doing any revisions, are you writing to specific characters or specific actors in your head? Like, oh, in an ideal world.
Oh, faces.
Yes.
I write visually, definitely. I don't think I ever really envisaged anyone in the roles in that way. I think they were more sort of hybrids of famous faces. I know that sounds a bit strange, but I always need something to sort of lock onto. And particularly actually when I'm writing dialogue, because I always find it much easier to imagine a face saying it and to sort of hear it in my head that way.
I do like when you say like a hybrid. I imagine like those images where they take two people and you could smash together and see what their kids look like.
Yeah.
And like,
whoa, that's it.
This is Tom Cruise and Tom Hanks. Whoa. Oh boy. All right. Yep. Yeah. I need that face.
Yeah. That is it. Face smash writing.
So let's talk about this cast. I mentioned, so you've written the script. You go through with Margot and the rest of the producing partners. You kind of hammer out all the beats and whatnot. And then it starts time to start casting this film.
Mm.
The one I want to talk about first is Mike Myers. Somebody that an incredible talent, but one that does not work as often for, you know, and maybe he's just, you know, very choosy about the roles that he does, but you don't get to see him this often. How did you entice Mike Myers to join your production?
I mean, it's serendipity again, I have to say. Mike was, I think, the penultimate member of the ensemble to join, and the producers and I had always talked about finding someone totally unique for this sort of eccentric, quirky night janitor that that Mike played. And we wanted to just do something amazing with it. And I'm going to claim it was my idea, but I think it might be Margot's. We were sort of, you know, sort of throwing ideas backwards and forwards. And we were kind of like, what about Mike Myers? And, you know, kind of all slowly smiled, thinking he's never going to do it. And we got the script to him. He gave us a quick read. And 2 days later, he asked to speak to me. And we had a 4-hour phone call, which was a rather large phone bill between Budapest, London and New York. Never mind. And we just had the most amazing conversation. I mean, to be on the end of the phone to like a comedy legend, someone who I absolutely admired, someone whose characters I quoted all the time, who was giving the most incredibly concise and detailed notes. He'd come up with a whole backstory to this character that was actually hauntingly similar to mine, with some massive improvements. And then we started discussing the look and the sort of the physicality of it and what he would want to do with it. And I was just nodding, like, you know, to everything he was saying. And yeah, he sort of said to me, he said, look, I read 100 scripts a year. Like, I don't do anything, but I really want to do this. I really want to play this part. At which point I sort of fell over in the hotel room. But he was amazing. I mean, he elevated the part beyond anything, you know, I could have imagined. He brings such precision. He brings such hard work, you know, to it. And he creates, he calls it silhouettes. You know, he creates these really deep characters that, and you can see why, you know, Dr. Evil and Austin Powers and all these things are so well loved, because they're so developed, they're so sort of intensively researched and thought about, and, you know, to see him bring that to Terminal was just an absolute pleasure to watch.
So in terms of for the part that Mike plays, the gentleman older has a limp as well too. Are those things that Mike said, like, yep, these are the things I think that this character would have, or is these things that are already in the script?
So I think he was described in the... I imagine him having a limp. He's described as sort of shuffling and slightly decrepit. But what Mike then did was sort of elevate that and start specifying it, so it didn't just become a sort of caricature thing. He was talking about where he might have hurt his leg. He would talk about where this janitor might wear his keys, you know, because he wanted there to be that sort of... Well, the character to create this sort of creepy sort of sonar thing where, you could hear the keys shaking and people would know he was coming. And, you know, it was all of these... It was Mike's specificity that kind of bought... real, like, you know, truth to a character like that, that he became not just a sort of archetype, but something that had real depth.
The jump back to the conversation, you said, like, Mike says, like, I'd like to talk to you, and we talk for 4 hours. Is it just all business related, or do you also need to, like, just, we need to just chat about just some general things, just to see if we even just, as people, just kind
100%, because I think it's vital, isn't it? And I mean, we talked about everything. We were talking about Saturday Night Live, we talked about Wayne's World, we talked about Austin Powers.
Can you not just fan out? Is it just you fanning out at Mike Myers for a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just, yeah. But, I mean, massively. But, you know, it was also a lot of, you know, it would always sort of come back to what we, you know, what we were talking about. And there were just, it was just a pleasure, you know, like, you know, it was a real kind of, we covered everything. And, you know, we talked about soccer. He's a big Liverpool fan. I'm a big Spurs fan. You know, we had a bit of, you know, a nice sort of hateful moment over that. And, yeah, it was brilliant.
The look of the janitor, he's older than, of course, Mike is, so there is prosthetics involved. Is that just something that how much is it you and Mike kind of working together to figure, like, oh, yeah, in terms of how we want to age this gentleman up to make him look old and decrepit? Is that you two of you collaborating?
It was, you know, Mike is a world expert at prosthesis. He understands it inside out. He was incredibly kind and generous to us in that he has a prosthetic artist in New York who he had, you know, create stuff for the old guy, as we called the janitor. And, it, you know, he's so specific. He's so determined to make it perfect, you know, from the shape of the cap to, you know, the way that the wrinkles sit on his face to the way that the teeth sit in his mouth. And, it, you know, just to see something like that come alive is amazing.
And is the first time that you see him is pretty much the first day of filming in terms of the full makeup? Or had he been out there earlier and you'd already seen, like, the prosthetic tests?
No, I'm trying to think when it was that we first saw. No, we'd actually started shooting because we were, you know, we were hoisted by our own petard, right? We had this unbelievable cast, all with, you know, other commitments, all with hard outs, and, you know, we needed to condense our shoot days. And the first time I saw Mike in full janitor garb was the second day of shoot when he arrived on set to show me, having had the final prosthetics fitted. I'd seen some prosthetics tests before that. Try saying that after a bit. And I just remember him shuffling. He was backlit because we had a big mole beam down that end of the terminal where we were shooting, and he was backlit, shuffling towards me, whistling. Well, actually, his assistant was whistling, who whistled "Danny Boy," which is kind of, you know, a haunting melody that runs through the film. And I was just looking at him like, yeah, that's happened. That's Mike Myers as the janitor shuffling towards me. I mean, it was an amazing moment.
That is the next question. I'm glad you answered that for me, because my greatest fear would be to be cast in something where they say, all right, you've got to whistle, and I cannot whistle to save the life.
You know, so whistling is very important in this film. Not one of the cast could whistle. As far as I know, I think Dex can whistle, actually. So, but I mean, as there were so many lucky things on this production. Mike's assistant, Andrew, was like a world-class whistler. World-class. So we wild-tracked him whistling, and that runs all the way through the film. That's we had great. 1 minute of him whistling perfectly in an amazing kind of echoing space, and everything was built by the sound designer, Nicola, from that whistle.
Well, I feel like that's smarter Mike Myers' part. If you're going to hire an assistant, you know, have them have qualities that you don't have, so, you know, to help you out in moments like this.
Yeah. Oh, that Mike Myers. Yeah.
So you shoot down in Budapest. Mm-hmm. In terms of the structure for the terminal, it's in a really cool set. How much of that is an actual location, or how much of it is all built inside a soundstage?
It's all location. So the Budapest is astonishing, and one of the things that I specified actually within the script was I was trying to create this world reminiscent but not recognisable as our own, and what I wanted to do was take a city that had sort of that faded, Austro-Hungarian it was, but that sort of faded grandeur, that, you know, the sense of like Dickensian London that was sort of falling away, and to try and juxtapose that with kind of very brutalist like Sovblok architecture. And that literally is Budapest. It's, you know, got this beautiful architectural past through, you know, through the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and then obviously when it was part of the USSR there were these kind of crazy utilitarian like concrete behemoths just built in the center of Budapest. And you know, everywhere we looked, we wrecked it 6 weeks out, and by we arrived on the Monday morning by about 12 o'clock, we're just phoning everyone just like, get out here, please come to, please come to Budapest, bring everything. But that train shed, as we called it, was designed by Gustav Eiffel, who obviously designed some big tower somewhere, but
you may have heard of it.
But he built the biggest train station in Budapest, the Eastern Station, so the footprint of that was very similar. So we had this incredible brick, slightly mildewed building that was just absolutely... I mean, it had, like, stepped off the page when we first did it. Myself and the production designer were just like, this is unreal. And obviously, we then had to light and dress this absolutely enormous building with no money and no time. And they did an incredible job.
Now, this is a terminal that's no longer in use? Or?
No, it's defunct, yeah. In the story, or...?
Or in real life?
No, it was. I think they actually just use it to repair trains now.
Okay.
So there were certain things, there were certain architectural features that really played into our hands. So there was a space that they drove the trains into in order to repair them that resembled tracks. And one of our reference points was Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which I absolutely love, and I love the colours, and I love the use of sort of the noir send up, and mm-hmm. you know, it's just a brilliant film. And in the terminal there were these sort of porter cabins on stilts, and we were like, that's like the bar in Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Could we put the cafe in there? And sort of all, we were very, you know, inspired by location, as we needed to be, you know, and the locations are incredible. And you know, Richard looked at it. He said, yeah, I think we can make it work. I'll take this and I'll build it in another wing of the shed, and we'll shoot the exteriors onto this, and then we'll build an interior set, which was the cafe, that sort of workman's caf mixed with American diner, you know, because Terminal was always trying to be, you know, very contradictory in terms of, like, the palette that we use, trying to use different motifs and ideas from different eras and sort of combining them and creating a sort of kaleidoscopic collage. And yeah, it all sort of came from finding these amazing locations and working out how best to utilize them with no time and no money.
That's, well, I guess the benefit of it being no longer in use on a regular basis makes it much easier for your production. You don't have to worry about, like, oh, we got to clear out because they're actually using this for you know, real trains to
yeah.
go through.
Oh yeah, no, that yeah. When we shot the Metro, we shot a scene in the Hungarian Metro. We had the most amazing location department. And so they got us 6 hours in the Metro, which is like unheard of for a film of our size. And we did a really important scene down there. But one of the lines was no trains till tomorrow. And we were only allowed to film at the hours that there were no trains, civilian trains. So as Mike, one of the first times, as we just got in there, we just got it up and running, the scene was on its feet. He said, no trains till tomorrow now. You just hear, and this giant freight train carrying waste just like came through asthmatically slowly, like comically long, like Austin Powers pee long.
Yeah.
Oh, man, honestly. So, yeah. But, I mean, Budapest was just a dream. Like, you know, we had such kind of varied inspiration points. Like, we wanted to be really sort of genre reverential with the film. Like, you know, it was a film kind of made by people that love movies. And, you know, we looked at things like, you know, Ridley Scott's Blade Runner or 1984, Children of Men, Seven, Fight Club, Brazil. Gilliam's Brazil was a big influence on us. And we just wanted to draw inspiration points and sort of, you know, put them together. And we were very lucky because we weren't beholden to an era or to a period. We could borrow from different eras and periods and put them together in whatever manner we wanted.
Well, for you, because you're creating this whole world, how much of it is you just envisioning this world, the ins and outs of it, that don't even make it, that you need to have in your head, but that actually don't make it into the script?
I had a very, very detailed idea in my mind when I came to it, and when I sat with the cast and sat with the crew to go through it. But what I found was that people were really drawn to the idea of being able to be sort of sensationalist, to embrace the hyper-real and to sort of go with the crazy. And, you know, I remember sitting with Julian Day, the costume designer, and showing him sort of ideas and inspiration points. And, you know, he took out his laptop and he had thousands of pictures, like infinitely better than mine. And, you know, I mean, costume and makeup specifically, we had this idea of each of the ensemble having a look that was reminiscent but not quite recognisable of a certain look. I mean, obviously, Annie is very chameleonic and has loads of different looks, but... So Dexter, Vince, had this sort of fading teddy boy feel, and, you know, his young upstart partner had a sort of Bowie Berliner chic about him. Bill, we modelled on a sort of Winston from 1984, look, you know, if the boiler suit was a suit, right? And, you know, wanted to make it kind of dowdy and slightly dulled down and sort of reflective of his mood. And then Mike, you know, obviously created this amazing sort of shuffling, you know, shuffling janitor-esque costume with me, which was great.
The now, one thing you do with the screenplay is that there's a fractured narrative. There is some. What are the challenges of working with a fractured narrative in terms of you just got to make sure at the end? Is it as simple as I'm going to write it linear and then I'm just going to just split it myself and just put pieces where I want? Or is there more in that goes into it when you want to fracture the narrative?
It was a combination of both. I wrote a treatment in linear order, because that was really important to me, because my pea brain couldn't check that it was right and it needed to be narratively. I mean, the other thing was that Terminal focuses on two interweaving narratives, and then there's a third subtext that runs through as well. And in order to make sure that the fractured narrative also held up with the undulating, you know, sort of storylines, it was a bit of a trip, actually, yeah. But I love films where time is fractured. Nolan is probably the most obvious example of an astonishingly brilliant filmmaker who doesn't, you know, he challenges his audience. You know, you've got to sit up and pay attention, and I love that as a film fan, and it's something that I sort of wanted to bring to Terminal. I didn't want to pander to the audience. I wanted them to feel engaged in, you know, anyway, so they were on the journey and kind of joined the pieces together themselves.
Do you, as you're writing this, I'm only envisioning somebody when they decide they want to do a fractured narrative. They've got a wall in their office where they've got the note cards and everything and strings looping around.
Wild hair as they pull it. Yeah, no,
just making sure everything lines up perfectly.
Yeah. Index cards for me. Yep. Yeah, I really like different coloured index cards. That really worked, actually, just in terms of laying stuff out. And it's also, when you start moving things around, you know, there are ramifications and knock-ons of when you move scenes. And one of the things that we needed to try and keep away from was having a scene from narrative A running into another scene from narrative A. If it was in a different time period, we needed to punctuate it with the other narrative. And that was, yeah, there was quite a lot of me staring at a wall going slowly insane. Yeah. There was nothing on the wall.
But you're just staring at it anyway. Yeah. Were you able to kind of lock all those down right there in the script process, or was it a lot of it also in the editing too, when you're seeing how this film's starting to cut together, realizing, oh, wait, I need something else to come in between these two scenes to kind of give it a little breather?
Very much a combination of both. It was airtight as a script. David Barron, who was an astonishing producer, who came on quite late in the day, he produced Tarzan, and we met through Margot. And he's probably most known for producing the Harry Potter films.
Oh, those little small films.
Just some indie stuff. But one of the most amazing things that he did right from the outset was he said, we need to cut this script down, we need to make it tighter, and we need to make it quicker, and we need to make sure that any temporal issues that are raised in it, we can answer ourselves. We have to have full confidence in it, when we have to know these timelines inside out. So if you can't answer a question, it needs to be changed. And that really, really helped, because when we turned up to, you know, a very intensive shoot, and, you know, shooting nights when everyone's brains are a bit fried anyway, you know, to know that you could trust in the script, you could trust in the narrative journey, that was really important. And then we threw it all out the window when we edited. No.
Where were you when you had the script and then he comes on? How much did you really have to kind of go back and rethink and refigure out?
No, not a great deal. A lot of it actually was because David, you know, being a brilliantly successful commercial filmmaker, had his eye on making sure that the mainstream audience would really buy into this film, and that it was accessible, so it could be enjoyed, and, you know, wasn't needlessly pretentious, something I'm often accused of being. So he, you know, it was about sort of whittling it down and really distilling it down to its essence, really. And he was brilliant in post as well, because obviously when you get to the edit, you do have the freedom to start experimenting with things. And I was blessed with two amazing editors, Johannes Bock and Alex Marquez. And Alex did the second leg of it, and we really, they weren't big changes, but they were very elegant tweaks that weren't in the initial script, but that we suddenly found, you know, worked better, that made the story sort of unravel in a more satisfying way.
So when you first get into the edit bay and you start putting it all together, what's your first original cut? How long does it go?
It was pretty on point, actually. Nice. It was just under 2 hours. But we one of the things that we really talked about a lot was having, like, packing a punch. Like, you know, we were thinking in that sort of, you know, late night double feature length, you know, something in that sort of, you know, really, you know, top-notch B-movie territory, in that, you know, the 90-minute mark. It's, mm-hmm. you know, traditionally films were at 90 minutes, and I think we come in at 94 or something like that. So once the assembly cut had been put together, we looked at where it felt baggy or where it felt ponderous, and we tried to sharpen it. We tried to keep it fresh and dynamic and interesting, which is what we always wanted to do, something that was unique and eccentric but exciting.
For you, is that are those easy cuts to make, or are those times where you're glad that you have that team with you to realize, like, I am too close to this. I need a second set or even a third set of eyes to look at this?
That it was horrible. No, it was all right. I mean, you can see the improvements. And, you know, sometimes you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but there are points where you need to accept that a scene is too long, and you need to accept that something hasn't worked. And you know what? Sometimes it's because, you know, it was a difficult night. Sometimes it was because we got into a location late, and, you know, we didn't quite have the time to shoot the scene in the way that it had been envisaged. There are always problems that you have when shooting that you don't want to see in the final film, and a lot of the tweaking came about from that.
I saw in one interview you said one of the things that you learned about this is that always make sure you shoot your inserts.
Oh my God, shoot your inserts. Shoot your inserts, shoot your cutaways. Yeah. Yeah. That's for you, Molly Hassel. No, it you know, because you genuinely don't know when you're going to have another, when you're going to have a change of heart, or when something isn't going to work. And it's amazing what you can use in other places. Like, you know, once you have all the raw materials, I mean, literally, that, you know, the dailies, that they are the raw materials from which you're going to build the film, you can use things in the most unlikely places. And we had an incredible camera operator called Ian Mackay, who was a good friend of the cinematographer Chris Ross as well. And he went off and he would, you know, he didn't have the money for a second unit or anything like that, but he would take the camera and he would often pick up amazing inserts, or he would pick up moments where he'd go into a set after we had been there and he'd do some brilliant cleanup stuff. And he's also very much responsible for some of the more eccentric and exciting camera angles within the film. You know, he had a big Wong Kar-wai thing going on for sure. Lots of Dutch angles and lots of short siding.
There is one sequence that I really liked how it was shot. Is there's a scene where Simon Pegg and Margot Robbie, they're talking in the cafe, talking about some future possibilities for Simon's character. And you play them while they're in the cafe, but you kind of drop the front side of the cafe and you start playing those, and they're almost like watching it like they're watching a film. That was a really cool sequence. How was that? Was that something that was kind of conceptualized from the beginning, or how did that kind of idea kind of come about?
It was conceptualized early on. It really cemented once we knew our locations, because we'd always had the idea that this became this sort of cozy, intimate, macabre chat took on this kind of odd, surreal, like slightly kind of hypnotic vibe as it got a bit later and they'd broken out the gin. And I knew it was intensively prepared, because a lot of it relied on camera technique. It involved on transitions, practical transitions, so cameras ducking through tables and coming out into other locations, and, you know, utilizing a crane in order to get to the height for certain things. And we rehearsed it rigorously, both in terms of the cast and also mechanically. And then what we did was we took dressing from the cafe and put it into, you know, other locations. And I think it gives it this kind of really interesting sort of broken fourth wall perspective. You know, it's quite interesting to sort of see the play within the play.
No, that was really so, because I thought it was a really cool sequence. And part of me was like, they probably just put green screen and then they're just showing
God, that. No, we don't have money for green screen. No, it's all practical. Every bit of it, yeah.
Oh, that is so cool. Yeah. Now, Lauren,
aside from some gunshots, yeah.
That you learned that you actually had to build the cafe set there. So you're right, it makes it easily transportable to whatever location you want to shoot within the rest of the world.
Yeah, I mean, look, it was the brilliance of Chris and Richard and my wonderful wife, who was the art director, and they They worked out what they needed to take from the cafe, and we worked out some really vital pieces of dressing. And when we rehearsed, we worked out the choreography of what the cast needed to do in order to have, you know, sort of seamless editing points where they would, you know, lean back in one, and then we would cut to the inside of the cafe, and they'd be in the process of finishing the lean back. And no, it was all achieved practically. Apart from a train as well. Train and gunshots, they weren't practical.
There is one other location. I was curious if this was also in the terminal area, where Margot and Simon, they kind of go up to explore like a deep, dark tunnel or pit.
Yeah.
Was that a practical location inside the terminal?
No, that was a practical location. It was a water plant, a water processing plant just outside of Budapest. Cool. And it was a health and safety nightmare that somehow the amazing production crew wrangled. I mean, it was dangerous, this place, when we wrecked it. And they made it workable, and it was lit in that beautiful, slightly sci-fi way that Chris Ross did, Brittany did, and Richard dressed it incredibly.
I like the way that was shot, too, where a lot of it would be from under, inside, looking up at them. I thought that was a really cool angle to look at that. When you're scouting that, is that just something you're looking up and noticing? How the design on the ceiling, they're like, oh, that's really kind of cool. Look, why don't we shoot it from down at this angle looking up?
Yeah, I kind of really facetiously said to Danny, the line producer, and to Richard, find me Star Wars. Find me the Han Solo Star Wars death. And and they found this incredible, you know, this location that was just absolutely stunning. And we went down there, we went into the bowl to look up, and it was, it was amazing. You know, and I mean, that was the thing. Budapest gave us so much, and we wanted to utilize all of this incredible architecture, and we wanted the film to have scope and scale. It was really important to us that our aspirations and our ideas weren't defined by the budget. So, you know, where we could, we used big locations, and they were lit beautifully and dressed cleverly. And yeah,
for you, given, you know, certainly an independent film, so you're dealing with logistical and budget nightmares, cast demands, and their schedules to work all out. For you, is every day shooting, is it just the nerves hitting you every day? Or was there a point in the process where you're like, if I just get up to this, I know I got it, and the rest, it'll take care of itself?
I mean, honestly, no, because of having so much set experience. I was terrified on a daily basis. Like, you know, I was pinching myself, going, look at the world-class cast and crew that are around here listening to the ridiculous things that I'm saying and having to nod. No, I was blessed, and they were so supportive, and you know, it was an incredible set to work on. It was really convivial. Like, everyone was in the trenches together, you know, sleeves rolled up, like, just doing their best to make this film. We had 27 nights and you know, big ideas. But I mean, for me, I prepared, as you know, really well. I mean, I worked, you know, I shortlisted as much as I could. I rehearsed as much as I could. You know, any conversations that we could have before the day, we would have, because, you know, I've been around enough brilliant directors to know that sometimes, you know, those bubbles of inspiration that come up on set, those moments of creative genius, you need to leave room for that. And the only way you can do that is to be really prepared, so that if a good idea comes up, you've got enough time to roll with it.
Well, and you're right, when you have that kind of cast lined up, who's going to be? Mike, thanks for the idea, but please, just follow the script. Thank you.
I got this. No, I mean, you know, and I mean, Simon, you know, who I just think turns in the most astonishing performance. I mean, he is the most incredibly warm and generous guy, and he's such a phenomenal actor, and he elevated the black comedy in his character to such a level. I mean, I'm forever grateful to him anyway for doing it. He was an absolute hero of mine. I had a Shaun of the Dead poster on my wall when I was at uni.
Well, you know, I noticed at the beginning where you just said, oh, you know, my close personal friend Simon Pegg showed me this.
I did
this
not
America
say that.
Video.
For clarity, Pegg, I did not say that. That was Frank.
That was me. I assumed that. I felt like that was the unsaid thing that was in that sense.
Unsaid.
It was it.
I mean, yeah, he's one of my heroes. To call him a friend is an honor, yeah.
That's what a great thing to be able to work with people that you have admired and find out, as they say, like, don't meet your heroes, but the opportunity to get to work with them, and they're just as great as you would always imagine that they were.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, we caught him at a really kind of the perfect moment. He was just finishing Mission Impossible, and he was just about to start Ready Player One, and he wanted to do something indie. He wanted to you know, get his teeth into something. And yeah, and we had lunch, and he you know, we talked in depth about the character, talked about the uni that we both went to, and he just said, look, I'd love to do it. You know, if you'll have me, I'm there. And I sort of, again, nearly fell off my chair. Yeah.
So the film comes out, Terminal comes out in theaters and video on demand on May 11th.
Yes.
Yes. Now, if what do you have coming up next? You finally, you're on the big press brief for this. You can put this aside shortly. What's next in your kind of your target?
Vast swathes of unemployment.
What?
No, so I'm working. I've got some really, really interesting stuff I'm working on at the moment. I'm adapting a graphic novel series called Smoketown, which is about a Rust Belt sort of Midwest town. And on one level, it's a small crime thriller. But on a bigger level, it's an amazing sort of satirical take on modern America, and it's you know, it touches on amazing subjects, you know, in a really interesting sort of, you know, it's got a great crucible at it. This kind of small crime story that centers around one murder, and you know, it talks about immigration, it talks about this disintegration of sort of, you know, the American industry, it talks about the opioid epidemic. It's a brilliant, brilliant piece, and they haven't actually finished the series yet, so I'm working with the author of the graphic novel, and we're sort of, you know, we've got this kind of symbiotic relationship. He's retconning things he would have preferred to have done differently, and I'm sort of giving him ideas for the penultimate episode.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So I assume, though, in terms of adapting this, will the ending, the way you want the story to end for film, differ from the way that he wants to do it for the graphic novel?
No, I think there's been a bit of a meeting of the minds, actually. We were talking about it, and we've kind of come to the same conclusion. Well, I mean, he has, and I agreed with him.
I will not make this movie. Yeah. You don't agree to my decision. Yeah. Well, Vaughn, I know you eschew social media.
I don't eschew it. I just don't use it. I guess I eschew it. You're right.
But if fans want to check in on what is happening with Terminal, what's the best place for them to go to find out more about the film?
I want to say #Terminal Movie.
You can say that.
I think that is it. Thank you. #Terminal Movie. RLJ are the US distribution company who are doing a fantastic job. I think they have a Twitter page, and that's about all I know. I'm going to look there. Yeah. Samantha might be able to
help.
That's
right.
No, she's got nothing.
There you go.
No,
perfect. Yes. She. That was a reassuring shake of the head. Like, yes.
Yeah. We'll take that well. As that.
Yes. Yeah. Vaughn, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming
by.
No,
thanks so much for having me. It's been great.
Pleasure is all mine. We're going to let Donald Glover sing us out again. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us for this episode of iTalk Movies. Make sure to check out Terminal when it's in theaters and on video demand on May 11th. That's actually tomorrow as we record this, so look at this. But folks, thanks for joining us here for this episode of iTalk Movies. My name has been Frank Moran. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at HappyGoJackie. We'll see you back here for another episode of iTalk Movies right here on Popcorn Talk. Take care.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.